Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 97. It's Monday, January 18th, 2021. I'm recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Today is Martin Luther King Day. Happy MLK Day. And of course, the favorite quote from MLK regarding healthcare and public health is that of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And as anybody who's listened to my show regularly, I'm committed to reporting health inequities. Many of them are racial and ethnic related. And we'll get to some more of those in today's show, as in most shows. And I am proud to run the People School of Public Health here in the University of Life. Well, COVID-19 keeps dominating the public health news, as today we're expected to hit 400,000 COVID-19 deaths. And I wouldn't want to just cover one little ongoing pet peeve in the last couple months here with this new variant. I keep hearing the term, no more deadly. And of course, this means for any given case, this variant or variants do not seem to be any more deadly. But of course, getting the disease at all is in fact what drives the death, primarily. So it would be similar to if you got a cancer diagnosis and the little comfort you'd get from your doctor telling you, well, you've got stomach cancer, but the good news is stomach cancer is no dangerous than it was last month or 10 years ago or what we expect it to be in the future. That doesn't really mean very much if you have stomach cancer. And it's the same way with COVID-19. The point is to avoid getting it. Now, obviously, if we get better treatment, that makes the severity go down if you're able to get those treatments. But for a pandemic, for the epidemic in this country, avoiding infection in the first place is the primary driver of the seriousness of this epidemic as a nation. Okay, well, since this new variant or variants that are more infectious seem to be the biggest issue here in COVID-19 and in public health, we're going to do a few stories on that. This from Stat News. New coronavirus variant could become dominant strain in March, CDC warns. A new, more transmissible variant of the virus that causes COVID-19 could sweep the United States in coming weeks and become the dominant strain as soon as March, leading to a new surge of cases through the spring, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned. The CDC believes a variant known as B.1.1.7 is still circulating at low levels in the U.S. Only 76 infections caused by the new variant have been detected in 12 states, though testing for it has not been routinely conducted. CDC officials acknowledge the variant is likely more widespread here than is currently recognized. Modeling work done by CDC scientists suggests that unless the pace of vaccination of the population increases dramatically and people adhere stringently to COVID-19 control measures, the new variant will spread rapidly. The work was reported last Friday at CDC's online journal Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. We're concerned, Jay Butler, CDC's Deputy Director of Infectious Diseases, told Stat. We want to sound the alarm and urge people to continue to do the things that we know work. The B.1.1.7 variant, first reported in the United Kingdom transmits more easily from person to person. It is thought that people infected with it develop higher levels of virus in the upper respiratory tracts. Some studies suggest the variant is about 50% more transmissible than existing iterations of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. To date, there isn't evidence that shows the variant triggers more severe disease, but that's of little assurance, given the speed at which it spreads. Hospitals in many parts of the country are already at or near capacity. A tsunami of new cases could lead to a sharp decline in the quality of care overall. And even if the death rate stays stable, an increase in cases will fuel the already enormous death toll in this country. Butler said there is no evidence the current surge of cases in many parts of the country is due to the new variant. The modeling effort estimated that without the new variant and with an effective rollout of vaccine, the rate of new cases in the country should have started to decline in February and March. But the vaccine rollout is not going smoothly. Vaccine supplies are limited and will remain so for weeks. And now there's a new variant to contend with. Efforts to prepare the healthcare system for further surges in cases are warranted, the authors of the article contended. Okay. Also from Stat News, COVID-19 deaths are the highest they've ever been, and the more infectious variants could make things much worse. As horrific as the U.S. COVID-19 outbreak looks now, it's almost certainly to get worse. They've raced through South Africa, the United Kingdom, and increasingly elsewhere. And now, new, more infectious variants of the coronavirus have gained toeholds in the United States. If they take off here, which with their transmission advantages they will, unless Americans rapidly put a brake on their speed, it will detonate something of a bomb in the already deep, deep hole the country must dig out of to end the crisis. In other countries, scientists fear the variants will reignite outbreaks in places where the virus has already been tamped down. But in the U.S., which averaged more than 250,000 new infections every day in the last week, and where more than 4,000 people are dying some days from COVID-19, the variants could accelerate what's already exponential spread in certain areas and make reigning in the U.S. epidemic all the more difficult. I'm very, very concerned that we've now gone from a virus that we could control to a virus that we really can't unless we do something very dramatic, said Christian Anderson, an infectious disease expert at Scripps Research Institute. A spike in infections on top of the existing caseloads could force hospital leaders to consider how to surge capacity, staff, and resources, and weigh what happens if they have too many patients to care for. It could force schools to close again or delay plans to reopen. The variants are also ramping up the pressure on the country's sputtering vaccine rollout to try to protect more people and snuff out transmission before the variants become dominant. Epidemiologists stress that this country still has a chance to contain the variants before they become widespread, but only if public health authorities can keep ahead of them. It would require an expansion of testing and genomic sequencing to identify where the variants are starting to spread and prioritizing contact tracing and quarantining programs to sever chains of transmission. Americans would need to redouble their efforts to wear masks, and I would add better masks, physical distance, and avoid gatherings. It would be no small feat. The variants loom at a time when health departments are exhausted and stretched thin, and many people are weary of COVID-19 precautions. Just as the arrival of vaccines was providing a light at the end of the tunnel, this is like a last-minute twist that creates more problems, said Northwest University's Alessandro Vespignani, who models how emerging diseases spread. Scientists in the UK, for example, identified the country had a fast-spreading variant in December, but looked back and noticed the B117 first appeared in their sequencing data in September. In Ireland, where transmission is among the highest in the world now, B117 accounted for 8.6% of sequenced cases 1 week, then 12.8% the following week, then 24.9%. Now it's making up roughly half the cases. Plus, because of the lack of surveillance, it's not totally clear where in the building up process the variants are in the country. We don't know what our current position is, says infectious disease epidemiologist Caitlin Rivers, the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Are we on week one? Are we on week six? And we haven't just noticed. As scientists watch the variants building up in other countries, they see it as a preview of what could happen in this country without further action. In a way, it's reminiscent of how the U.S. dawdled at the initial wave of COVID-19 cases surged into the country last year, not absorbing that the virus that tore through China and then Italy was on its way to doing the same in the U.S. And more. from NPR. The new UK coronavirus variant is in the US. Here's how fast it could spread. Scientists are sending the US a warning. What's happening right now in the United Kingdom with the new coronavirus variant could likely happen in the US, and the country has a short window to prepare. I feel a sense of deja vu right now about the situation we were in back in the spring, said epidemiologist Emma Hodcroft at the University of Bern in Switzerland. I think a lot of countries are looking at the UK right now and saying, oh, isn't that too bad that it's happening there, just like we did with Italy in February. But we've seen in this pandemic a few times that if the virus can happen somewhere else, it can probably happen in your country too. The new variant called B117 appears to be significantly more contagious than previous versions of the virus. It has been spreading rapidly in the UK and causing a huge surge in cases, hospitalizations, and death. Last week, the UK reported a record-breaking 419,000 cases. The governments of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland issued strict lockdowns, urging people to stay inside their homes. And I must note that 419,000 cases in the UK is not that much different. It's on the same order of magnitude of what we already have happening in the U.S. without apparent widespread transmission of this more infectious variant. Yikes. Okay, studies suggest the new variant increases the transmissibility by about 50%. While restrictions have largely suppressed previous versions of the virus in the UK, B117 has continued to grow exponentially. Now scientists say the virus is already here in the U.S. and circulating widely, albeit at very low levels, says computational biologist Trevor Bedford at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. A rough estimate for across the U.S. would be a frequency of about 1 in 1,000, he told NPR last week. So about 1 in every 1,000 COVID infections is due to the variant. Bedford expects the percentage to rise quickly. In England, B117 took about 3 months to take over and become the dominant strain in the outbreak. Scientists believe the variant first emerged by September. By December, it had become the dominant version in London. So I roughly expect a similar timeline of 3 months from the variant's initial arrival in the U.S. in December to starting to dominate the virus population around March, Bedford said. According to Bedford, the U.S. still has about 2 months to prepare for and slow down the variant. On the surface, that timeline sounds like good news, but the findings are worrying, Bedford says. They mean the steep rise in cases and hospitalizations that is already happening in some states can't be blamed on a more contagious virus. I think it's not at all really conceivable that this more transmissible variant has contributed to surging cases in the U.S. this fall and winter, he says. We're kind of just barely getting started with this variant. Yet, the outbreak in the U.S. is the worst it's ever been. The U.S. reported its most deadly day of the pandemic on last Tuesday with a record 4,327 people dying of COVID that day. Each week, more than 1.5 million people test positive for the virus across the country. Several states like California, Arizona, and Rhode Island have some of the highest infection rates in the world. The U.S. needs to be thinking about how to minimize damage from this new variant right now, Hodcroft says. This is our early warning, because by the time you have something spreading exponentially in your country, it's much harder to get under control. What needs to be done will be different for each community. Activities that seemed relatively safe before, like outdoor dining, might not be as safe with the new version of the virus. Communities should start thinking about acquiring better masks or suggesting ways people can improve their masks. Cities and states can ramp up testing and contact tracing. They can start contact tracing and contact tracing the variant to try to slow down its spread. And finally, the entire country needs to focus on vaccinating people as quickly as possible. Otherwise, Bedford says, in March, we will likely see another wave of the virus. I was expecting that by around March, things would be getting decently under control in the United States, he says, because the weather would warm up and more people would be immune through the vaccine or natural exposure. Those factors will bring the previous version of the virus under control, he says, but not the new variant. My expectation now is that we end up with a spring wave of this new virus variant. Whew. Okay. Well, in this article, what I find really interesting and fits into why we're having this deja vu moment is that when you say, oh, well, 1 out of 1,000 of the cases are this new variant, and you say, well, how bad can that be? But like they've said, in the UK, it took about 3 months for it to become the dominant thing. And if you look at 12 weeks of doubling, if you start with one, let's do that. You have one case at 0.0 At 1 week, you have 2, and then 4, and then 8, and then 16, then 32, 64, 125, I'm rounding for sake of math here, 250, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000. So from one case, after 12 weeks of doubling, you could have 4,000 cases. So say the current epidemic, you have 1,000 cases of the old one and 1 of the new. After 12 weeks, assuming that the new variant, say, holds steady, you'd have 1,000 of the old, slower transmission virus, and you'd have 4,000 of the new. That would mean that 4 out of 5, 80% of the COVID cases after 12 weeks under that scenario would be the new variant that 12 weeks earlier was literally 1 in 1,000. This is why infectious disease pandemics are dangerous. And I must add, in the U.S., given the fact that we don't really seem able or willing to crank it down a little bit more, I think the scenario in that last article is probably going to come true. I think the next 3 to 6 months is going to be a really serious race between getting vaccinations and trying to stave off this new variant or variants that are more infectious.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, now it's time for the local update for Lucas County and COVID-19. Well, the average daily cases over the last 7 days went from 285 last week to 229, so it went down a bit. But, of course, testing is the real issue. As I've been kind of complaining about for months about testing in general and the positivity rates, being able to even track that specifically, last week I reported that if you took the most recent 9 weeks, that we had a positivity rate in Lucas County of 46%. Well, I had the genius idea this week to, let's look at the positivity rate for all time, meaning all the tests that have been reported to date since the beginning of the pandemic in Lucas County. And the positivity rate for all time since last February, 23.8%. And again, we're trying to get that under 5% as an indication of having decent level of testing to be able to deal with the pandemic. 23.8%. And the reality is we're likely over 40% today. Okay, well, we're at 23.8% positivity rate, the number of people who, percent of people who get tested who end up being positive. And in Ohio, that was 9.7%, and nationally, it was 8.4%. So you can see that locally, we're doing a lot worse than both Ohio and nationally, and that neither in Ohio nor nationally are we doing very well compared to an objective standard or metric for success. Ohio ranks 35th among states for testing per capita. That's likely better than actually the very beginning of the epidemic, but we don't rank very well as a state. Okay, well, good news on the state as far as the positivity rate. It's dropped from 13.8% to 10.9% in the most recent week. And if you want to the fact that we're all doing bad makes you feel better, there's only one state that has a positivity rate under the recommended 5%. And that is the great state of Delaware. Okay, well, Ohio testing volumes actually edged down last week and were similar to levels back to beginning November when cases were just beginning to rise quickly and with only about 40% of the number of identified infections each day as today. And the average amount of time it takes for a positive test to be returned, 3.7 days, which edged up from 3.4 days the previous week. Still taking way too long. That's really should be like 24 to 48 hours. And we're basically double that. Okay, nursing homes, again, it's not doing well. We're sticking near highs with 192 active cases in Lucas County, which is the same as the prior week. That was 118 residents and 74 staff. The positivity rate was not reported, I think because of the Martin Luther King holiday, but at last told it was 18%. Not very good. That's 18% in Lucas County. Okay, Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days is higher than the state rate and similar to the national death rate. And with a total of 56 deaths in the last 14 days in Lucas County, we're back up to the death rate, which is similar to previous highs in Lucas County in recent weeks, like in December. Okay, well, we got no more data, no update or correction from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services data as far as Lucas County COVID-19 hospitalizations and ICU occupancy. Last week, for some reason, they kind of screwed up the update, and then there is no update for this week. So the Trump administration ends with a wondrous incomplete for data and surveillance for hospitalizations. Okay, UT is actually starting to do their surveillance testing. They did have 16 positives through their surveillance testing and for symptomatic testing. And they had a 1.7% positivity rate for those that were randomly selected for surveillance testing. And Lucas County schools, they're starting to do reporting again, starting to get back to school. And we had 68 staff and 92 students that reported positive tests, new infections in the most recent week. And there's not a whole lot I can probably really say about that other than that's not wildly different than the infection rates in the community. The fact that we don't have any kind of regular testing program in the schools doesn't really allow us to say much. I mean, I'm glad that University of Toledo does something that gives us a little bit of a clue, and the 1.7% positivity rate, which is it's been in that ballpark for a long time, is similar to what the community rate is. Okay, vaccinations. In Ohio, as of today, we have given the first dose to 444,534 Ohioans. That's 3.8% of the population of Ohio. Okay, in Lucas County, we've had 18,660 people got their first dose, and that's 4.36% of the Lucas County population. So, as before, it looks like Lucas County is doing slightly better than the state at getting vaccinations out. Still, both at the state, local, and national levels, we're seeing more estimated new infections than immunizations. Yikes, we need to change that metric. Okay, well, as of last Thursday, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department had pre-registered 44,000 Lucas County residents for immunizations. That means you can go on to their website, lucascountyhealth.org, and register, and they will keep you updated. And for instance, like this most recent week where people age 80 and above fall into the current prioritization for immunizations, they will send you an email or contact you letting you know that you can register to actually set up an appointment to get a vaccination. So about of those 44,000 that pre-registered, about 24,000 of them fit into the priority 1B that they're currently immunizing. But of course, Lucas County is receiving about 6,000 doses per week, it seems. So it's going to be hard to keep up. But if you'd like to pre-register, go to lucashealth.org, where you can fill out the online form, or you can get full information on the 23 local vaccination sites. You can call 211 on any phone for language assistance or poor internet access for some help. Or you can call the Area Office of Aging. They'll give assistance for those age 65 plus to help you register. That number for the Area Office of Aging for assistance for getting an immunization appointment is 419-382-0624. Okay, well, if you want to look into the future, as a cautionary tale, we can always look to Los Angeles. This from the LA Times. Darkest days for LA doctors, nurses, EMTs. The way most people leave is by dying. At a hospital near South Los Angeles, doctors debate whether an elderly patient should be hooked to one of the few remaining ventilators. Meanwhile, nurses at Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center in Westwood fear they are treating too many patients to provide them all with the best care. And for emergency medical technicians, racing the sick to hospitals has become an obstacle course with not enough beds for the hundreds of patients in need. Once an ambulance that has responded to a 911 call finds a hospital, it can take up to 17 hours to offload the patient. There are dark days for Los Angeles County doctors, nurses, and EMTs, marked by a level of death once unimaginable in the United States, despite tireless efforts to treat patients. It's a war zone, said one doctor in the LA County Public Hospital. The way most people leave is by dying. But amid the exhaustion and anguish of the last several weeks is something worse. Fear that the next few weeks will be even more dire. Another COVID-19 surge, fueled by the recent holidays, is beginning to swell. And the looming question is how big an uptick hospitals will face. Officials say even small increases in demand could trigger grim measures that would further compromise cases, compromise care. Already, so many people are dying in LA County that hospital morgues and funeral homes are often full. In the last week, 200 people a day were dying of COVID-19 in the county, more than the number of deaths from all other reasons combined, which average 170 a day. So I've reported earlier, like nationally, where we've reached, you know, COVID-19 as the leading cause of death. This actually is much worse than that. This is where COVID-19 is killing more people than all other causes combined. Yikes. A doctor at one of LA County public hospitals has heard families wail on the phone in agony that their loved one is dying. We spend our days calling families to let them know their loved one has exhausted all medical treatment and are going to pass away despite our best efforts, the physician said. The hospital's emergency room is packed with patients waiting to get into the intensive care unit, where space typically opens up only when someone dies. Patient care is suffering because ER staffers aren't trained to care for ICU patients and have many of their own to attend to, the doctor said. But the next phase of the pandemic could be worse. LA County hospitals so far have generally avoided having to make the most heart-wrenching decisions, choosing who receives aggressive life-saving care and the limited time of the best-trained professionals and equipment, and who will be treated only for comfort as they die. Teams of triage officers, usually led by critical care and emergency doctors, would make those calls. At Ronald Reagan UCLA, there are tents outside the ER to triage and treat the patient overflow. Staffers are struggling to keep up as they are assigned more patients than they can handle, said ER nurse Marcia Santini. We have a real unsafe situation, she said. It's really scary. The state last month granted waivers permitting hospitals to increase the number of patients nurses can treat at one time. California law typically allows ER nurses to be assigned no more than four patients, but the loosening of regulations has bumped that up to six at some hospitals. We do not shy away from hard work. We do not shy away from taking care of patients. But what we do want is to work in a. But what we do not want is to work in an unsafe environment, and that's what it's become, Santini said. We understand we're going through unprecedented times, but if we don't have enough staff in these areas or the equipment, then it's really hard to take care of somebody. The once clear division between COVID and non-COVID patients have broken down as the hospitals filled up, she added. In the ER, she can treat a COVID patient minutes before seeing someone with another illness. That makes additional stress. Oh my God, am I protected correctly? Did I change my gloves? Did I change my mask? You have to think every time before you go into another room, she said. You could have a COVID patient, and you could have a patient coming in with complications with cancer, and you have to be really careful not to cross-contaminate. Other hospitals are already facing tough decisions about how to distribute limited resources. A nurse at St. Francis Medical Center in Linwood said providers discuss how to distribute the scant supplies of high-flow oxygen and BPAP machines, which help COVID-19 patients breathe. A doctor at the hospital described a recent argument about whether to put a critically ill patient on one of the remaining ventilators. The team ultimately decided not to. This kind of scenario is going to continue happening, and it's sad and traumatic for medical teams to be put in this position on a daily basis, the doctor said. At St. Francis, any separation between COVID and non-COVID patients has disappeared, with the ER functioning as an open-air ICU, the doctor said. Nurses are assigned more patients than they can handle, and patients line the hallways unmonitored. The problems extend outside hospital walls. Emergency medical technicians who respond to 9/11 calls are dealing with bottlenecks, extreme wait times, and sickened staff. While we're trained to deal with crises, something like this has never been seen in anyone's lifetime that's in healthcare right now, said Tom Wagner, chief executive for the Western Region of American Medical Response, one of the country's largest ambulance service providers. The flood of patients, along with increasingly sick healthcare workers and the lack of ICU beds, is resulting in crippling delays when it comes to offloading patients at hospitals. Before the pandemic, an ambulance could be back on the road within minutes of arriving at a hospital. Now, EMTs are regularly waiting 4, 5, or even 10 hours to offload a patient, said Jeff Lucia, CARE's communication director. On Wednesday, I heard as much as 13 hours, he said. Wagner said he's aware of wait times as long as 17 hours. That's time that a patient is on an ambulance gurney, which is a little uncomfortable for them, at a hospital waiting to be brought in, Lucia said, adding that even if CARE were to put more ambulances on the road, most would end up just sitting there. Ambulance crews are also experiencing a reduction in staffing due to the spread of the coronavirus. More than 170 of LA Fire Department's responders are in isolation due to COVID-19, said Dr. Mark Eckstein, the department's EMS Bureau commander. Meanwhile, several dozen of the ambulance company's 500 LA caregivers are in various stages of quarantine on any given day, Wagner said. The LA County Emergency Medical Services Agency has issued a directive advising ambulance crews to conserve oxygen for patients whenever possible. But Lucia said the contents of the small tanks within ambulances are being used up during the long delays outside hospitals. The county's directive also told ambulance crews not to transport to hospitals patients who no longer have a pulse, can't be resuscitated at the scene, and have an extraordinarily limited chance of survival, a scenario that is increasingly likely as the number of sick patients climb. Eckstein said cases of cardiac arrest more than doubled in November and December compared with 2019, a reflection of the impact of COVID-19. It's really a nightmare, Santini said, because you're being forced to do things you would never do. Okay, well, next up, we have one final lie and public health deception from the Trump administration. This from The Hill. Governors say no additional vaccine dose is coming despite Trump administration promise. Governors are accusing the Trump administration of lying about the availability of additional coronavirus vaccines, following an announcement from top officials that doses will no longer be held in reserve. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said last week the administration would no longer be holding back the second of two doses and encourage states to open vaccination eligibility to more people. But governors say there is no reserve and their limited supply of vaccines will not increase. Instead of being able to dramatically expand access to millions more people, states will have to continue to manage at their current levels. They will also changed federal recommendations to prioritize everyone 65 and older, as well as people 60 and older with at least one high-risk medical condition, an extra 150 million Americans. There's only 330 million Americans total, so that's almost half of them. According to the paper, Operation Warp Speed stopped stockpiling second doses of the Pfizer vaccine at the end of last year. The last shots held in reserve of Moderna's vaccine supply were shipped out to states last weekend. weekend before last. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Friday said the state's allocation actually decreased this week from 300,000 doses down to 250,000 doses. The Trump administration said they would expedite the second dose. It turns out that was not true. They had already sent out everything they had, so there was no increase in supply. In the meantime, there was a dramatic increase in eligibility, Cuomo said. What they did was like opening the floodgates of eligibility, and that entire flood has to go through a syringe. That's the situation the federal government has created, he added. Okay, well, as a nation, we're approaching about a million doses per day, but of course, the currently approved vaccines require two doses to be fully immunized, so that's really about 500,000 people a day in the long run that will get immunized. At that rate, it would take well over a year to get up to herd immunity. If we move up to the million people per day vaccinated, and again, the Biden administration is talking about a million a day, but they're talking about a million doses. That's not a million people fully immunized. So again, that's 500,000. But even if we get up to a million people with two full doses, which would mean an average of 2 million doses a day, that will still take about 8 months to get up to herd immunity. So the virus is obviously racing on its own, but the race to get the vaccine out is really critical the next 3 to 6 months with these new variant or variants very likely to become dominant in the U.S. COVID-19 epidemic. The good news is if we get the vast majority of high-risk individuals vaccinated, then death rates could plummet. But it's still likely that even, you know, 6+ months from now, depending partly on the vaccination's ability to prevent infections and their ultimate efficacy in the widespread population, it's still feasible that we could continue for months and months to have 500 deaths per day. Obviously, that's better than the 4,000 plus that we've been doing here. Not unusually, but still, 500 a day is a health crisis of its own. Okay, well, even with a pandemic in the U.S. that was only there for about 8 months of 2020, it still substantially reduced life expectancy in the U.S. This from Science Daily. COVID-19 reduced U.S. life expectancy, especially among Black and Latino populations. The COVID-19 pandemic, which claimed more than 336,000 lives in the United States in the year 2020, has significantly affected life expectancy, USC and Princeton researchers have found. The researchers project that due to the pandemic's deaths last year, life expectancy at birth for Americans will shorten by 1.13 years to 77 and a half years, according to their study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. That is the largest single year decline in life expectancy in at least 40 years and is the lowest life expectancy estimated since 2003. The declines in life expectancy are likely even starker among minority populations. For Blacks, the researchers project their life expectancy would shorten by 2.1 years to 72.8 years, and for Latinos by just over 3 years to 78.8 years. Whites are also impacted, but their projected decline is much smaller, 0.68 years, to a life expectancy of 77.8 years. Overall, the gap in life expectancy between Blacks and whites is projected to widen by 40% from 3.6 years to more than 5 years, further evidence of the disease's disparate impact on disadvantaged populations. COVID-19 appears to have eliminated many of the gains made in closing the Black-white life expectancy gap since 2006. Latinos who have consistently experienced lower mortality than whites, a phenomenon known as the Latino paradox, would see their more than 3-year survival advantage over whites reduced to less than 1 year. The huge decline in life expectancy for Latinos is especially shocking, given that Latinos have lower rates than the white and Black populations of most chronic conditions that are risk factors for COVID-19, said study co-author Noreen Goldman, the Hughes Roger Professor of Demography and Public Affairs at the Princeton School of Public Health and International Affairs. The generally good health of Latinos prior to the pandemic, which should have protected them from COVID-19, has laid bare the risk associated with social and economic disadvantage. I would like to just make an editorial note here that earlier when I was talking about death, the severity of this pandemic, it's related to getting the most infections, and Latinos have been the highest risk for getting infection. So even though they're healthier to start out, it's created more death just from the sheer number of infections that they've been exposed to. Okay, back to the story. The bigger reductions in life expectancy for the Black and Latino populations result in part from a disproportionate number of deaths at younger ages for these groups, Goldman said. These findings underscore the need for protective behaviors and programs to reduce potential viral exposure among younger individuals who may not perceive themselves to be at high risk. Life expectancy is an indicator of population health. The researchers say life expectancy is an important indicator of a population's health, an informative tool of examining the impact of COVID-19 on survival. In the decades before the COVID-19 pandemic, annual improvements in U.S. life expectancy had been small, but overall life expectancy had rarely declined. With exceptions, an exception was the annual reduction of 0.1 years for three consecutive years, 2015, 2016, and 2017, which were attributed in part to increases in so-called deaths of despair among middle-aged whites related to drug overdoses, including opioids, as well as alcohol-related liver disease and suicide. The projected pandemic-related drop in life expectancy is about 10 times as large as the declines seen in recent years. I would also reiterate something that I reported earlier on a previous episode, is that the increase death, and in this case, life expectancy, the number of years that are lost, is actually higher and more disproportional in younger populations than in older populations. In other words, years of life lost are more likely to be in younger populations, obviously, because if you die when you're 30 years old, you lose many more years of potential life than you would if you die when you're 78 years old. Now, obviously, older people die much more frequently, but when you sum the number of years that are of potential life that are lost, you see that the smaller number of younger people who actually die, but relative to their low death rates outside of the pandemic, it actually jacks up and drives the decrease in overall life expectancy for the entire population. So it's not just about raw numbers, people. I mean, when young people die, it has a bigger impact. And it's not just old people that are dying. You need very few young people to die to really lower your life expectancy numbers. Okay, well, over half a century after Martin Luther King's assassination, I am mourned to report this from ProPublica. Black men have the shortest lifespan of any Americans. This theory helps explain why. The unrelenting stress of fighting systemic racism can alter a body's normal functioning until it starts to wear down. The theory, known as John Henryism, helps explain racial health disparities. COVID-19 has killed many young black men with deadly efficiency. When ProPublica reporters began collecting their stories and speaking to health experts to understand why, their efforts led them to a little-known body of research that takes its name from one of the most enduring symbols of black American resilience. Sherman James is a social epidemiologist who has spent the last four decades exploring why black men have higher rates of disease that lead to shorter lifespans than all other Americans. His conclusion is that the constant stress of striving to succeed in the face of social inequality and structural racism can cause lasting physical damage. The stress is enormous, and people don't give up, James said. That persistence, working twice as hard over time, can really impair multiple physiological systems. As the legend goes, John Henry was a steel-driving man who defeated a steam-powered drill and died with a hammer in his hand. The folktale celebrates one man's victory against seemingly insurmountable odds, but it holds another, harsher truth. His determination and strength are also what killed him. The John Henry of contemporary social theory is a man striving to get ahead in an unequal society. The effort of confronting that machine day in and day out leads to stress so corrosive that it physically changes bodies, causing black men to age quicker, become sicker, and die younger than nearly any other U.S. demographic group. It's this striving to make something of themselves, to live their lives with dignity and purpose, and to be successful against extraordinary circumstances, James said. What is John Henryism? Black people have much higher rates of hypertension, obesity, diabetes, and strokes than white people do, and they develop these chronic conditions up to 10 years earlier. Studies link these health problems to stress. The unique, unrelenting strain caused by racism can alter a body's normal functioning until it starts to wear down. John Henrys, who battle with unequal systems as they try to get ahead in life, bear the consequences in their bodies. The stress, James said, is going to be far more overwhelming than it has a human right to be. The stress linked underlying conditions that black people develop younger are the very ones that make people more vulnerable to the worst outcomes from the coronavirus. When the Brookings Institute examined COVID-19 deaths by race, black people were dying at roughly the same rate as white people more than a decade older. They could have done so much more had the struggle not been so intense, James said. They were cut down too soon. And I'm going to actually, on that note, introduce a new feature. There's a lot of articles that I run into that are really too long to report in an hour show when I can hardly report on all the things that I discover right now. A little bit more long-form journalism. So I'm going to place a long article that's really good on this John Henryism with specific case studies and more research backing it on the Facebook page for the health of it. So you can just search on Facebook for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, and I will post that article. Please read it and like the page to get notified for other long-form articles and when new shows are posted. Okay, well, this week we are out with an old administration and in with a new administration at the federal level. So this from Stat News, Biden's appointment of a health disparities advisor is historic. But will the White House empower her? President-elect Biden's slate of high-level health care appointments includes an unprecedented selection. The first ever presidential advisor with the sole focus of combating racism and racial disparities in health care. Since December, Marcella Nunez-Smith has served as a top Biden advisor and the chair of the incoming administration's new task force specifically focused on combating pandemic-related health disparities. Her work, Biden has said, will ensure that, quote, fairness and equity are at the center of every part of our response. Amid a pandemic that has devastated Black, Latino, and Native American communities, health equity experts have uniformly applauded Nunez-Smith's appointment. By including the Yale physician and health disparities researcher in Biden's inner circle, they argued, the incoming administration has signaled an extraordinary commitment to combating health care injustice. But all the same, her appointment left behind a key question. What will her job actually entail? One needs to have decision-making power and a seat at the table to really be shaping upstream policy decisions and resource allocation decisions, said Alondra Nelson, a former colleague of Nunez-Smith at Yale and the president of the Social Science Research Council. The role itself is really important, but the role itself is insufficient. So far, the Biden campaign has provided little detail about Nunez-Smith's specific role. In response to questions from Stat, a campaign spokesperson provided only a brief job description. Nunez-Smith, she said, will report directly to Jeffrey Zients, the former Obama administration economist who Biden has tapped to serve as his COVID-19 coordinator, overseeing the administration's pandemic response. She will also help to oversee the pandemic response efforts from healthcare agencies and the federal government more broadly, the spokesperson said, citing specifically the Department of Health and Human Services, Veterans Affairs, Labor, Housing and Urban Development, Homeland Security, State and Defense, among others. The spokesperson declined to share more specifics about Nunez-Smith's responsibilities, including whether she'd have a staff or to what degree she'd have decision-making power in Biden's administration health policy debates. Three health equity advocates who spoke with Stat were clear about one thing. Just having a high-ranking official focus on the issue was a huge step up. Nunez-Smith has advised Biden for months already. Her experience as a co-chair of Biden's coronavirus task force, alongside David Kessler and Biden's Surgeon General nominee Vivek Murthy, will only expand the access she already enjoys to all aspects of the administration's pandemic response. It matters to have a position that is approximately cabinet level and have the ear of and regular contact with the executive, said Nelson. That's just as important to the extent that you can help to amplify all the work that is taking place in these other bodies. Coordinating will also be critical, the expert said. They point out, for example, that it's impractical to ask Americans exposed to COVID-19 to skip work and quarantine unless they receive housing support and paid sick leave, initiatives that would require cooperation from HUD and the Department of Labor. Nunez-Smith will also serve as a liaison between the Biden administration and communities of color. That role will likely be critical amid the push to encourage all Americans to seek COVID-19 vaccines, given the broad vaccine hesitancy nationwide. Public health officials have specifically cited the need to gain Black communities' buy-in for the vaccination effort, even amid widespread distrust of the medical establishment in light of past ethical abuses. But Nunez-Smith has urged caution. In an interview with Stat following her appointment as a co-chair of Biden's coronavirus task force, she argued that singling out communities of color or even suggesting that historically marginalized groups should receive priority vaccine access can be a double-edged sword. People of color all hold the memories of experimentation that are not all that distant, she said. It didn't just start with Tuskegee or Henrietta Lacks, so you can really understand if there are communities that are wary to be called out in that way. Feels like another way of continuing experimentation. The wide-ranging portfolio means the full scope and details of Nunez Smith's assignment likely won't be known to the public until well after Inauguration Day. But in general, advocates aren't concerned about the lack of detail in her assignment. In interviews, they argued Nunez Smith's experience in patient advocacy and research, along with her time spent advising Connecticut governors on COVID-19, will all equip her for the new role. Nunez Smith's highest profile appointments include serving as the chair of the Southern Connecticut Sickle Cell Disease Association's Medical Advisory Board, and since this summer, as one of Biden's top pandemic advisors. She is also the Yale School of Medicine's first ever Associate Dean for Health Equity Research and an accomplished researcher. She serves as a lead investigator in a number of federally funded studies, one of which included a five-year project to study the factors linked with heart disease and diabetes in the Caribbean, including the U.S. Virgin Islands, her birthplace. Nunez Smith's work at the Sickle Cell Advocacy Group will also foreshadow her future responsibilities. Sickle cell disease, she said, disproportionately plagues people of African descent and is long gone ignored. Only in recent decades have federal research authorities and pharmaceutical companies begun to research new treatments and cures. It's unprecedented for the White House to appoint a high-level advisor whose expertise lies principally in the field of health equity, but that doesn't mean the federal government doesn't devote resources to the cause. To the contrary, there is a substantial federal infrastructure devoted to combating health disparities. The Department of Health and Human Services houses a sub-agency called the Office of Minority Health, and there's a similar office embedded in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Separately, the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities funds over $300 million in research grants each year. Nunez Smith herself has won several. Nunez Smith's appointment has already earned plaudits from the woman who helmed the Obama administration's health equity network, Nadine Gracia, who served as director of the Office of Minority Health and currently works as the COO of the public health group Trust for America's Health. She will have great colleagues to work with throughout the federal agencies, embedded within the minority health and health equity leadership structure, Gracia told STAT. Under Trump and throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, however, the federal offices focused on health equity haven't played a major or public role in responding to the crisis. That has led advocates to criticize the officials in charge and the Trump administration more broadly for remaining silent amid COVID-19's devastation to communities of color. Nunez Smith herself has been outspoken regarding the country's and the government's failures not only to care for people of color during COVID-19, but to simply collect data about which communities are suffering most. We cannot address what we cannot see, Nunez Smith said last month during a Kaiser Family Foundation briefing. We are making a choice every time we allow poor quality data to hinder our ability to intervene on racial and ethnic equities. That is, inequities. Okay, well, I want to end the show with a few stories that are a little more good news. This from The Nation's Health, the publication of the American Public Health Association, and this is updating continuing coverage that I've had regarding this. Communities recognizing racism as a public health crisis. Declarations grow. Across the country, more jurisdictions are adopting resolutions declaring racism a public health crisis, citing growing research linking racism to poor physical and mental health outcomes, as well as data showing Black Americans are many times more likely than whites to be killed by police. As of November, about 150 states, cities, and counties had passed declarations, according to Tia Taylor-Williams, director of APHA's Center for Public Health Policy, while last year began tracking and sharing such declarations in an open access database. Williams said there are relatively few declarations on the books before the police killing of George Floyd on May 25th. However, the combination of his murder and racial disparities in COVID-19 deaths has helped expose the structural nature of racism and accelerated the pace of adoption. There are people who will view these declarations as purely symbolic, and in some cases that's true. But that symbolism is still very important, said Williams, who noted that the APHA Policy Center is working on a visualization project to map racism declarations. For far too long as a country, we've danced around and flat-out denied the impact and existence of racism. Williams said the declarations can provide a new opportunity to examine structural policies that reinforce inequities, enabling communities to begin dismantling and replacing systemic racism. In Genesee County, Michigan, work is underway to make sure a racism declaration adopted in June is translated into practice. Dr. Kent K, who authored the declaration, said stakeholders in Genesee County, home to the city of Flint, which also passed a racism declaration last summer, has been organizing around racial disparities for years, but he said it was important to see the declaration through a public health lens. Public health gives us the opportunity to engage and have dialogue around racism from a systems perspective, said Key, a disparities researcher and faculty member in Michigan State's University's College of Human Medicine. Key is a co-principal investigator in the Beyond Rhetoric Project, which is working to ensure that the Genesee County resolution goes beyond supportive statements. The project will develop a decision-making community action council, create a strategic plan for eliminating racist policies and practices, and develop a website to share widely anti-racist strategies, policies, and resources. Lisa Laparose, a co-principal investigator on the project, said a major goal is to share what is learned. If you're not looking at racism as a systemic problem, then it becomes a lot easier to ignore, said Laparose, an associate professor in the Department of Public Health and Health Sciences at the University of Michigan, Flint. And in more good news from Fierce Healthcare, ACA's coverage gains decreased income inequality. Coverage gains made and subsidies offered under the Affordable Care Act reduced income inequality by more than 10% in 2019, according to a new study from the Urban Institute, a left-leaning think tank. The study, backed by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and published in Health Affairs, found that for a typical person in the bottom 10th percentile of income, those who enrolled in a plan under the ACA saw their incomes increase by an average of 18.8%. In states that funded Medicaid, their incomes rose by an average of 22%. The study also found that coverage gains led to reductions in income inequality within and between age and racial groups. The researchers said that impacts like this should also be on the in the conversation on the potential effects of eliminating the ACA. In addition to gaining access to comprehensive health coverage, millions of uninsured people gain greater financial security by enrolling in the ACA, said Catherine Hempstead, senior policy advisor at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Any effort to eliminate or invalidate the ACA would have far-reaching consequences that include increased financial hardship for working families across the country. Okay, well, in this week of the mostly peaceful transition of power, this from JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. Get ready for a lot of Biden executive orders on healthcare. President-elect Biden proposed a sweeping set of healthcare initiatives during the campaign. The healthcare proposals include expanding testing of COVID-19, eliminating out-of-pocket costs for treatment, and providing additional pay and protective equipment for essential workers, increasing premium subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, capping premiums for all enrollees at 8.5% of income, creating a public health option administered by Medicare that would be available to anyone, including free coverage for people with low incomes in states that have not expanded Medicaid under the ACA, lowering the age of eligibility for Medicare to 60 years, giving the federal government the authority to negotiate drug prices for public programs and private payers, repealing the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funding of abortion services, eliminating the 5-year waiting period before lawfully present immigrants can enroll in Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. The Biden administration can also do much to push forward its healthcare agenda through administrative actions without Congress. Early on, Biden will likely focus on undoing what the Trump administration did regarding healthcare. This could include actions such as putting scientists and public health experts front and center in addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, re-entering the World Health Organization, reversing what Biden called Trump's sabotage of the ACA. That could include restoring a 90% cut in outreach and an 84% cut in grants to community-based navigators who help people enroll, as well as restoring the length of the ACA sign-up period, which Trump shortened. It could also include restricting enrollment in short-term insurance plans, which are not required to cover people with pre-existing conditions and were expanded by Trump. Repealing restrictions on immigration, like the public charge rule that penalized people for being sick, having a low income, or using public health benefits. Removing restrictions on family planning fundings for clinics like those operated by Planned Parenthood. Rescinding the Mexico City policy, which prohibits foreign aid to non-governmental organizations that provide or promote abortion services. Some of these administrative actions can be accomplished with a stroke of a pen. Others require complying with regulatory procedures, including an opportunity for public comment, which could take months or even years. The Biden administration can also nudge health reform forward on a state-by-state basis through Medicaid and ACA waivers, charting a very different direction from the Trump administration. In Medicaid, the Trump administration was has encouraged waivers that allow states to restrict eligibility and benefits, including work requirements, elimination of retroactive coverage, and greater leeway in operating the program in exchange for a cap on federal financing, which is a version of block granting. Under the ACA, the Trump administration has given states flexibility to redirect federal subsidies to short-term and other plans that do not cover pre-existing conditions or other required benefits, and permitted the elimination of healthcare.gov as an option to sign up for coverage, requiring enrollees to go through insurers or brokers. Waiver guidance said states should foster health coverage through competitive private coverage rather than public programs. President-elect Biden is expected to reverse the Trump administration waiver rules. He could go further and encourage states to use flexibility under the ACA and Medicaid to expand coverage and improve affordability for patients. A federal public option may be difficult to achieve politically, but waivers could facilitate state public options. States might even experiment with single-payer or Medicare-for-all type approaches, something Biden has opposed but might allow on a state-by-state basis. There are, to be sure, barriers to state-level reform. Because Medicaid and ACA waivers must be budget-neutral for the federal government, states would not have access to new resources. States also have their hands full right now with the COVID-19 pandemic and falling revenues. But in the years ahead, the stars could align for one or more states to move ahead on health care reform, in much the same way that health reform in Massachusetts under former Governor Mitt Romney using a Medicaid waiver paved the way for the ACA. A new experiment could be a model for a broader national health care debate. Okay, folks, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to queue up future shows, feel free to go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.